Side 4, Pebble in the Sky, continuing on page 109. Natter stopped. There was a queer coldness in his expression as he turned. "What's eating you, Bud?" Schwartz found the new language almost inadequate for the rapidity with which he hurled words at the other. "I'm tired of this acting. I know you, and I know what you're going to do. You're going to call somebody to tell them I'm going to Dr. Schecht. They'll be ready for me in the city, and they'll send out a car to pick me up. And you will kill me if I try to get away." There was a frown on Natter's face. He muttered, "You're sure right on the gizbo with that last." It was not intended for Schwartz's ears, nor did it reach them, but the words rested lightly on the very surface of his mind touch. Aloud, he said, "Mister, you've got me confused. You're shoving a fast one right past my nose." But he was making room, and his hand was drifting toward his hip, and Schwartz lost control of himself. He waved his arms in a wild fury. "Leave me alone, why don't you? What have I done to you? Go away! Go away!" He ended in a voice-cracked shriek, his forehead ridged with hate and fear of the creature who stalked him and whose mind was so alive with enmity. His own emotions heaved and thrust at the mind-touch, attempting to evade the clinginess of it, rid itself of the breath of it. And it was gone. Suddenly and completely gone. There had been the momentary consciousness of overwhelming pain, not in himself, but in the other. Then nothing. No mind touch. It had dropped away like the grip of a fist growing lax and dead. Natter was a crumpled smear on the darkening highway. Schwartz crept toward him. Natter was a little man, easy to turn over. The look of agony on his face might have been stamped on, deeply, deeply. The lines remained, did not relax. Schwartz felt for the heartbeat and did not find it. He straightened in a deluge of self-horror. He had murdered a man. And then a deluge of amazement, without touching him. He had killed this man just by hating him, by striking somehow at the mind touch. What other powers did he have? He made a quick decision. He searched the other's pockets and found money. Good. He could use that. Then he dragged the corpse into the fields and let the high grass cover it. He walked on for 2 hours. No other mind touch disturbed him. He slept in an open field that night, and the next morning, after 2 hours more, reached the outskirts of Schicka. Schicka was only a village to Schwartz, and by comparison with the Chicago he remembered, the motion of the populace was still thin and sporadic. Even so, the mind touches were for the first time numerous. They amazed and confused him. So many! Some drifting and diffuse, some pointed and intense. There were men who passed with their minds popping in tiny explosions, others with nothing inside their skulls but perhaps a gentle rumination on the breakfast just completed. At first, Schwartz turned and jumped with every touch that passed, taking each as a personal contact. But within the hour, he learned to ignore them. He was hearing words now, even when they were not actually mouthed. This was something new, and he found himself listening. They were thin, eerie phrases, disconnected and wind-whipped, far off, far off, and with them living, crawling emotion and other subtle things that cannot be described, so that all the world was a panorama of boiling life, visible to himself only. He found he could penetrate buildings as he walked, sending his mind in as though it were something he held on a leash, something that could suck its way into crannies invisible to the eye and bring out the bones of men's inner thoughts. It was before a huge stone-fronted building that he halted and considered. They, whoever they were after him. He had killed the follower, but there must be others, the others that the follower had wanted to call. It might be best for him to make no move for a few days, and how to do that best? A job? He probed the building before which he had stopped. In there was a distant mind touch that to him might mean a job. They were looking for textile workers in there, and he had once been a tailor. He stepped inside, where he was promptly ignored by everyone. He touched someone's shoulder. "Where do I see about a job, please?" "Through that door." The mind touch that reached him was full of annoyance and suspicion. Through the door, and then a thin, point-chin fellow fired questions at him and fingered the classifying machine under which he punched the answers. Schwartz stammered his lies and truths with equal uncertainty. But the personnel man began, at least, with a definite unconcern. The questions were fired rapidly. Age? 52? State of health? Married? Experience? Worked with textiles? Well, what kind? Thermoplastic? Elastomeric? What do you mean, you think all kinds? Whom did you work with last? Spell his name. You're not from Shika, are you? Where are your papers? You'll have to bring them here if you want action taken. What's your registration number? Schwartz was backing away. He hadn't foreseen this end when he had begun. And the mind touch of the man before him was changing. It had become suspicious to the point of single-trackedness, and cautious, too. There was a surface layer of sweetness and good fellowship that was so shallow and which overlay animosity so thinly as to be the most dangerous feature of all. "I think," said Schwartz nervously, "that I'm not suited for this job." "No, no, come back." And the man beckoned at him. "We have something for you. Just let me look through the files a bit." He was smiling, but his mind touch was clearer now and even more unfriendly. He had punched a buzzer on his desk. Schwartz, in a sudden panic, rushed for the door. "Hold him!" cried the other instantly, dashing from behind his desk. Schwartz struck at the mind touch, lashing out violently with his own mind, and he heard a groan behind him. He looked quickly over his shoulder. The personnel man was seated on the floor, face contorted and temples buried in his palms. Another man bent over him, then at an urgent gesture headed for Schwartz. Schwartz waited no more. He was out on the street, fully aware now that there must be an alarm out for him with a complete description made public, and that the personnel man, at least, had recognized him. He ran and doubled along the streets blindly. He attracted attention. More of it now, for the streets were filling up. Suspicion. Suspicion everywhere. Suspicion because he ran. Suspicion because his clothes were wrinkled and ill-fitting. In the multiplicity of mind touches, and in the confusion of his own fear and despair, he could not identify the true enemies, the ones in which there was not only suspicion, but certainty. And so he hadn't the slightest warning of the neuronic whip. There was only that awful pain, which descended like the whistle of a lash and remained like the crush of a rock. For seconds, he coasted down the slope of that descent into agony before drifting into the black. Chapter 13, Spiderweb at Washen. The grounds of the College of Ancients in Washen are nothing if not sedate. Austerity is the key word, and there is something authentically grave about the clustered knots of novices taking their evening stroll among the trees of the quadrangle, where none but ancients might trespass. Occasionally, the green-robed figure of a senior ancient might make its way across the lawn, receiving reverences graciously. And, once in a long while, the High Minister himself might appear. But not as now, at a half-run, almost in a perspiration, disregarding the respectful raising of hands, oblivious to the cautious stares that followed him, the blank looks at one another, the slightly raised eyebrows. He burst into the legislative hall by the private entrance and broke into an open run down the empty, step-ringing ramp. The door that he thundered at opened at the foot pressure of the one within, and the High Minister entered. His secretary scarcely looked up from behind his small, plain desk, where he hunched over a midget, field-shielded televisor, listening intently and allowing his eyes to rove over a choir or so of official-looking communications that piled high before him. The High Minister rapped sharply on the desk. "What is this? What is going on?" The secretary's eyes flicked coldly at him, and the televisor was put to one side. "Greetings, Your Excellency." "Greet me, no greetings," retorted the High Minister impatiently. I want to know what is going on. In a sentence, our man has escaped. You mean the man who was treated by Schecht with a synapsifier? The outsider? The spy? The one on the farm outside Schicka? It is uncertain how many qualifications the High Minister, in his anxiety, might have rattled out, had not the Secretary interrupted with an indifferent, "Exactly. Why was I not informed? Why am I never informed?" Immediate action was necessary, and you were engaged. I substituted, therefore, to the best of my ability. Yes, you are careful about my engagements when you wish to do without me. Now, I'll not have it. I will not permit myself to be bypassed and sidetracked. I will not. We delay, was the reply in ordinary speaking volume, and the High Minister's half-shout faded. He coughed, hovered uncertainly at further speech, then said mildly, "What are the details, Balkis?" "Scarcely any. After 2 months of patient waiting with nothing to show for it, this man Schwartz left, was followed, and was lost."
"How lost?"
"We are not sure, but there is a further fact. Our agent Natter missed 3 reporting periods last night. His alternate set out after him along the highway toward Schicka and found him at dawn. He was in a ditch at the side of the highway, quite dead." The High Minister paled. "The outsider had killed him? Presumably, though we cannot say certainly. There were no visible signs of violence other than a look of agony on the dead face. There will be an autopsy, of course. He might have died of a stroke just at that inconvenient moment."
"That would be an incredible coincidence."
"So I think," was the cool response. "But if Schwartz killed him, it makes subsequent events puzzling. You see, Your Excellency, it seemed quite obvious from our previous analysis that Schwartz would make for Schicka in order to see Schecht, and Natter was found dead on the highway between the Marin farm and Schicka. We therefore sent out an alarm to that city 3 hours ago, and the man was caught."
"Schwartz?"
incredulously.
"Certainly."
"Why didn't you say that immediately?"
Balkis shrugged.
"Your Excellency, there is more important work to be done. I said that Schwartz was in our hands. Well, he was caught quickly and easily, and that fact does not seem to me to jibe very well with the death of Natter. How could he be at once so clever as to detect and kill Natter, a most capable man, and so stupid as to enter Schicka the very next morning and openly enter a factory without disguise to find a job?
Is that what he did?"
"That's what he did. There are 2 possible thoughts that this gives rise to, therefore. Either he has already transmitted such information as he has to Schecht or Arvidsson, and has now let himself be caught in order to divert our attention, or else other agents are involved, whom we have not detected and whom he is now covering. In either case, we must not be overconfident."
"I don't know," said the High Minister helplessly, his handsome face twisted into anxious lines. "It gets too deep for me."
Balkis smiled with more than a trace of contempt and volunteered a statement. "You have an appointment 4 hours from now with Professor Bell Arvidsson."
"I have? Why? What am I to say to him? I don't want to see him."
"Relax. You must see him, Your Excellency. It seems obvious to me that since the date of commencement of his fictitious expedition is approaching, he must play out the game by asking you for permission to investigate the forbidden areas. Ennius warned us he would, and Ennius must know exactly the details of this comedy. I suppose that you are able to return him froth for froth in this matter, and to counter pretense with pretense." The High Minister bowed his head.
"Well, I shall try."
Bell Arvidsson arrived in good time, and was able to look about him. To a man well acquainted with the architectural triumphs of all the galaxy, the College of Ancients could scarcely seem more than a brooding block of steel-ribbed granite, fashioned in an archaic style. To one who was an archaeologist as well, it might signify, in its gloomy, nearly savage austerity, the proper home of a gloomy, nearly savage way of life.
Its very primitiveness marked the turning back of eyes to the far past. And Auverden's thoughts slipped away once again. His two-month tour about Earth's western continents had proven not quite amusing. That first day had ruined things. He found himself thinking back to that day at Shika. He was instantly angry with himself for thinking about it again. She had been rude, egregiously ungrateful, a common Earth girl. Why should he feel guilty? And yet, had he made allowances for her shock at discovering him to be an outsider like that officer who had insulted her and whose elegant brutality he had repaid with a broken arm? After all, how could he know how much she had already suffered at the hands of outsiders? And then to find out, like that, without any softening of the blow, that he was one. If he had been more patient, why had he broken it off so brutally? He didn't even remember her name. It was Pola something. Strange. His memory was ordinarily better than that. Was it an unconscious effort to forget? Well, that made sense. Forget. What was there to remember, anyway? An Earth girl. A common Earth girl. She was a nurse in a hospital. Suppose he tried to locate the hospital. It had been just a vague blot in the night when he parted from her. But it must be in the neighborhood of that Fudamat. He snatched at the thought and broke it into a thousand angry fragments. Was he mad? What would he have gained? She was an Earth girl. Pretty, sweet, somehow enticed. An Earth girl. The High Minister was entering, and Auverden was glad. It meant relief from that day in Shika. But deep in his mind, he knew that they would return. They, the thoughts, that is, always did. As for the High Minister, his robe was new and glistening in its freshness. His forehead showed no trace of haste or doubt. Perspiration might have been a stranger to it. And the conversation was friendly indeed. Auverden was at pains to mention the well-wishings of some of the great men of the Empire to the people of Earth. The High Minister was as careful to express the thorough gratification that must be felt by all Earth at the generosity and enlightenment of the Imperial Government. Auverden expounded on the importance of archaeology to imperial philosophy, on its contributions to the great conclusion that all humans of whatever world of the galaxy were brothers, and the High Minister agreed blandly and pointed out that Earth had long held such to be the case and could only hope that the time would shortly come when the rest of the galaxy might turn theory into practice. Auverden smiled very shortly at that and said, "It is for that very purpose, Your Excellency, that I have approached you. The differences between Earth and some of the Imperial Dominions neighboring it rest largely, perhaps, on differing ways of thinking. Still, a good deal of friction could be removed if it could be shown that Earthmen were not different, racially, from other galactic citizens." "And how would you propose to do that, sir?" "That is not easy to explain in a word. As Your Excellency may know, the two main currents of archaeological thinking are commonly called the merger theory and the radiation theory. I am acquainted with a layman's view of both." "Good. Now, the merger theory, of course, involves the notion that the various types of humanity, evolving independently, have intermarried in the very early, scarcely documented days of primitive space travel. A conception like that is necessary to account for the fact that humans are so alike one to the other now." "Yes," commented the High Minister dryly, "and such a conception also involves the necessity of having several hundred or thousand separately evolved beings of a more or less human type, so closely related chemically and biologically that intermarriage is possible." "True," replied Auverden with satisfaction. "You have put your finger on an impossibly weak point. Yet most archaeologists ignore it and adhere firmly to the merger theory, which would, of course, imply the possibility that in isolated portions of the galaxy, there might be subspecies of humanity who remained different, didn't intermarry." "You mean Earth," commented the High Minister. "Earth is considered an example. The radiation theory, on the other hand, considers us all descendants of one planetary group of humans. Exactly. My people, said the High Minister, because of the evidence of our own history and of certain writings which are sacred to us and cannot be exposed to the view of outsiders, are of the belief that Earth itself is the original home of humanity. And so I believe as well, and I ask your help to prove this point to all the galaxy. You are optimistic. Just what is involved? It is my conviction, Your Excellency, that many primitive artifacts and architectural remains may be located in those areas of your world which are now, unfortunately, masked by radioactivity. The age of the remains could be accurately calculated from the radioactive decay present and compared, but the High Minister was shaking his head. That is out of the question. Why? And Arverdon frowned in thorough amazement. For one thing, said the High Minister, reasoning mildly, what do you expect to accomplish? If you prove your point, even to the satisfaction of all the worlds, what does it matter that a million years ago all of you were Earthmen? After all, a billion years ago we were all apes, yet we do not admit present-day apes into the relationship. Come, Your Excellency, the analogy is unreasonable. Not at all, sir. Isn't it reasonable to assume that Earthmen, in their long isolation, have so changed from their emigrating cousins, especially under the influence of radioactivity, as now to form a different race? Arverdon bit at his lower lip and answered reluctantly, You argue well on the side of your enemy. Because I ask myself what my enemy will say. So you will accomplish nothing, sir, except perhaps to further exacerbate the hatred against us? But, said Arverdon, there is still the matter of the interests of pure science, the advance of knowledge. The High Minister nodded gravely. I am truly sorry to have to stand in the way of that. I speak now, sir, as one gentleman of the Empire to another. I myself would cheerfully help you. But my people are an obstinate and stiff-necked race, who over centuries have withdrawn into themselves because of the, lamentable attitudes toward them in parts of the galaxy. They have certain taboos, certain fixed customs, which even I could not afford to violate. And the radioactive areas are one of the most important taboos. Even if I were to grant you permission, and certainly my every impulse is to do so, it would merely provoke rioting and disturbances which would not only endanger your life, and those of the members of your expedition, but would, in the long run, bring down upon Earth the disciplinary action of the Empire. I would betray my position and the trust of my people if I were to allow that. But I am willing to take all reasonable precautions if you wish to send observers with me, or, of course, I can offer to consult you before publishing any results obtained. The High Minister said, You tempt me, sir. It is an interesting project. But you overestimate my power, even if we leave the people themselves out of consideration. I am not an absolute ruler. In fact, my power is sharply limited, and all matters must be submitted to the consideration of the Society of Ancients before final decisions are possible. Arverdon shook his head. This is most unfortunate. The procurator warned me of the difficulties, yet I was hoping that... When can you consult your legislature, Your Excellency? The Presidium of the Society of Ancients will meet 3 days hence. It is beyond my power to alter the agenda, so it may be a few days more before the matter can be discussed, say, a week. Arverdon nodded abstractedly. Well, it will have to do. By the way, Your Excellency... Yes? There is a scientist upon your planet whom I would like to meet... A Dr. Schecht at Schicker. Now, I've been in Schicker, but left before I could do much and would like to repair the omission. Since I'm sure he is a busy man, I wonder if I could trouble you for a letter of introduction. The High Minister had stiffened visibly, and for several moments said nothing. Then, may I ask what it is you want to see him about? Certainly. I have read of an instrument he has developed, which he calls a synapsifier, I believe. It concerns the neurochemistry of the brain and could have something very interesting to do with another project of mine. I have been doing some work on the classification of humanity into encephalographic groups, brain current types, you understand? I have heard vaguely about the device. I seem to recall that it was not a success. Well, maybe not, but he is an expert in the field and could probably be very helpful to me. I see. In that case, a letter of introduction will be prepared immediately for you. Of course, there must be no mention of your intentions with regard to the forbidden areas. That is understood, Your Excellency. He rose. I thank you for your courtesy and your kind attitude, and can only hope that the Council of Ancients will be liberal with respect to my project. The secretary entered after Arvidun left. His lips were spread in his characteristic cold, savage smile. Very good, he said. You handled yourself well, Your Excellency. The High Minister looked at him somberly and said, What was that last about Schecht? You are puzzled? Don't be. All things are working out well. You noticed his lack of heat when you vetoed his project? Was that the response of a scientist whose heart is set upon something withdrawn from his grasp for no apparent reason? Or is it the response of one who is playing a part and is relieved to be well rid of it? And again we have a queer coincidence. Schwartz escapes and makes his way to Schicka. The very next day, Arvidun appears here and, after a lukewarm rigmarole about his expedition, mentions casually that he is going to Schicka to see Schecht. But why mention it, Balkis? It seems foolhardy. Because you are straightforward. Put yourself in his position. He imagines we suspect nothing. In such a case, it is audacity that wins. He's going to see Schecht. Good. He mentions it frankly. He even asks for a letter of introduction. What better guarantee of honest and innocent intentions can he present? And that brings up another point. Schwartz may have discovered that he was being watched. He may have killed Natter. But he has had no time to warn the others, or this comedy could not have played itself out in just this fashion. The secretary's eyes were half-lidded as he spun his spiderweb. There is no way of telling how long it will be before Schwartz's absence becomes suspicious for them, but it is at least safe to allow sufficient time for Arvidun to meet Schecht. We'll catch them together. There will be that much less they can deny. How much time do we have? Demanded the High Minister. Balkis looked up thoughtfully. The schedule is fluid. And ever since we uncovered Schecht's treason, they've been on triple shift, and things are proceeding well. We await only the mathematical computations for the necessary orbits. What holds us up there is the inadequacy of our computers. Well, it may be only a matter of days now. Days. It was said in a tone queerly compounded of triumph and horror. Days, repeated the secretary. But remember, one bomb, even 2 seconds before zero time, will be enough to stop us. And even afterward, there will be a period of from 1 to 6 months when reprisals can be taken. So we are not yet entirely safe. Days. And then the most incredibly one-sided battle in the history of the galaxy would be joined, and Earth would attack all the galaxy. The High Minister's hands were trembling gently. Arvidun was seated in the stratoplane again. His thoughts were savage ones. There seemed no reason to believe that the High Minister and his psychopathic subject population would allow an official invasion of the radioactive areas. He was prepared for that. Somehow he wasn't even sorry about it. He could have put up a better fight, if he had cared more. As it was by the galaxy, there would be illegal entry. He would arm his ship and fight out if necessary. He would rather. The bloody fools. Who the devil did they think they were? Yes, yes, he knew. They thought they were the original humans, the inhabitants of the planet. The worst of it was, he knew that they were right. Well, The ship was taking off. He felt himself sinking back into the soft cushion of his seat and knew that within the hour he'd be seeing Shika. Not that he was eager to see Shika, he told himself, but the synapsifier thing could be important, and there was no use being on Earth if he didn't take advantage of it. He certainly never intended to return once he left. Rathole. Ennius was right. This Dr. Schecht, however, he fingered his letter of introduction, heavy with official formality, and then he sat bolt upright, or tried to, struggling bitterly against the forces of inertia that were compressing him down into his seat as the Earth still sank away and the blue of the sky was deepened into a rich purple. He remembered the girl's name. It was Pola Schecht. Now why had he forgotten? He felt angry and cheated. His mind was plotting against him, holding back the last name till it was too late. But deep underneath, something was rather glad of it. Chapter 14, Second Meeting. In the 2 months that had elapsed from the day that Dr. Schett's synapsifier had been used on Joseph Schwartz, the physicist had changed completely. Physically, not so much, though perhaps he was a thought more stooped, a shade thinner. It was his manner, abstracted, fearful. He lived in an inner communion, withdrawn from even his closest colleagues, and from which he emerged with a reluctance that was plain to the blindest. Only to Pola could he unburden himself, perhaps because she too had been strangely withdrawn those 2 months. "They're watching me," he would say. "I feel it somehow. Do you know what the feeling is like? There's been a turnover in the Institute in the last month or so, and it's the ones I like and feel I can trust that go. I never get a minute to myself. Always someone about. They won't even let me write reports." And Pola would alternately sympathize with him and laugh at him, saying over and over again, "But what can they possibly have against you to do all this? Even if you did experiment on Schwartz, that's not such a terrible crime. They'd have just called you on the carpet for it." But his face was yellow and thin as he muttered, "They won't let me live. My 60 is coming, and they won't let me live. After all you've done? Nonsense. I know too much, Pola, and they don't trust me." Know too much about what? He was tired that night, aching to remove the load. He told her. At first she wouldn't believe him, and finally when she did, she could only sit there in cold horror. Pola called up the State House the next day from a public communiwave at the other end of town. She spoke through a handkerchief and asked for Dr. Bell Arverden. He wasn't there. They thought he might be in Bonaire, 6,000 miles away, but he hadn't been following his scheduled itinerary very closely. Yes, they did expect him back in Shika eventually, but they didn't know exactly when. Would she leave her name? They would try to find out. She broke connections at that and leaned her soft cheek against the glass enclosure, grateful for the coolness thereof. Her eyes were deep with unshed tears and liquid with disappointment. Fool. Fool. He had helped her and she had sent him away in bitterness. He had risked the neuronic whip and worse to save the dignity of a little Earth girl against an outsider, and she had turned on him anyway. The 100 credits she had sent to the State House the morning after that incident had been returned without comment. She had wanted them to reach him and apologize, but she had been afraid. The State House was for outsiders only, and how could she invade it? She had never even seen it, except from a distance. And now, she'd have gone to the palace of the procurator himself to... Only he could help them now. He, an outsider who could talk with Earthmen on a basis of equality. She had never guessed him to be an outsider until he had told her. He was so tall and self-confident. He would know what to do. And someone had to know, or it would mean the ruin of all the galaxy. Of course, so many outsiders deserved it. But did all of them, the women and children and sick and old, the kind and the good, the Arverdens, the ones who had never heard of Earth? and they were humans, after all. Such a horrible revenge would for all time drown whatever justice might be, no, was, in Earth's cause, in an endless sea of blood and rotting flesh. And then, out of nowhere, came the call from Arverdon. Dr. Shett shook his head. I can't tell him. You must, said Pola savagely. Here? It is impossible. It would mean ruin for both. Then turn him away. I'll take care of it. Her heart was singing wildly. It was only because of this chance to save so many countless myriads of humans, of course. She remembered his wide, white smile. She remembered how he had calmly forced a colonel of the Emperor's own forces to turn and bow his head to her in apology. To her, an Earth girl, who could stand there and forgive him. Belle Arverdon could do anything. Arverdon could, of course, know nothing of all this. He merely took Shep's attitude for what it seemed. An abrupt and odd rudeness of a piece with everything else he'd experienced on Earth. He felt annoyed there in the anteroom of the carefully lifeless office, quite obviously an unwelcome intruder. He picked his words. I would never have dreamed of imposing upon you to the extent of visiting you, Doctor, were it not that I was professionally interested in your synapsifier. I have been informed that, unlike many Earthmen, you are not unfriendly to men of the galaxy. It was apparently an unfortunate phrase, for Dr. Schecht jumped at it. Now, whoever your informant is, he does wrong to impute any especial friendliness to strangers as such. I have no likes and dislikes. I am an Earthman. Arverdon's lips compressed, and he half turned. You understand, Dr. Arverdon, the words were hurried and whispered, I am sorry if I seem rude, but I really cannot. I quite understand, the archaeologist said coldly, though he did not understand at all. Good day, sir. Dr. Shett smiled feebly. The pressure of my work. I am very busy too, Dr. Shett. He turned to the door, raging inwardly at all the tribe of Earthmen, feeling within him involuntarily some of the catchwords that were bandied so freely on his homeworld. The Proverbs, for instance. Politeness on Earth is like dryness in the ocean. Or, an Earthman will give you anything so long as it costs nothing and is worth less. His arm had already broken the photoelectric beam that opened the front door when he heard the flurry of quick steps behind him and a hiss of warning in his ear. A piece of paper was thrust in his hand, and when he turned, there was only a flash of red as a figure disappeared. He was in his rented ground car before he unraveled the paper in his hand. Words were scrawled upon it. Ask your way to the Great Playhouse at 8 this evening. Make sure you are not followed. He frowned ferociously at it and read it over 5 times, then stared all over it as though expecting invisible ink to bound into visibility. Involuntarily, he looked behind him. The street was empty. He half raised his hand to throw the silly scrap out of the window, hesitated, then stuffed it into his vest pocket. Undoubtedly, if he had had one single thing to do that evening other than what the scrawl had suggested, that would have been the end of it, and perhaps of several trillions of people. But as it turned out, he had nothing to do. And as it turned out, he wondered if the sender of the note had been... At 8 o'clock, he was making his slow way as part of a long line of ground cars along the serpentine way that apparently led to the Great Playhouse. He had asked only once, and the passerby questioned had stared suspiciously at him. Apparently no Earthman was ever free of that all-pervasive suspicion, and had said curtly, "You just follow all the rest of the cars." It seemed that all the rest of the cars were indeed going to the playhouse, for when he got there, he found all being swallowed, one by one, into the gaping maw of the underground parking lot. He swung out of line and crawled past the playhouse, waiting for he knew not what. A slim figure dashed down from the pedestrian ramp and hung outside his window. He stared at it, startled, but it had the door open and was inside in a single gesture. "Pardon me," he said, "but shh." The figure was hunched down low in the seat. "Were you followed?" "Should I have been?" "Don't be funny. Go straight ahead. Turn when I tell you." My goodness, what are you waiting for?
He knew the voice. A hood had shifted down to the shoulders and light brown hair was showing. Dark eyes were gazing at him.
You'd better move on, she said softly.
He did, and for 15 minutes, except for an occasional muffled but curt direction, she said nothing. He stole glances at her and thought, with a sudden pleasure, that she was even prettier than he had remembered her. Strange that now he felt no resentment. They stopped, or Arvidun did, at the girl's direction, at the corner of an unpeopled residential district. After a careful pause, the girl motioned him ahead once more, and they inched down a drive that ended in the gentle ramp of a private garage. The door closed behind them, and the light in the car was the only source of illumination. And now Pola looked at him gravely and said, Dr. Arvidun, I'm sorry that I had to do this in order to speak to you privately. I know that I have no standing in your good opinion to lose.
Don't think that, he said awkwardly.
I must think that. I want you to believe that I fully realize how small and vicious I was that night. I don't have the proper words to apologize. Please don't. He glanced away from her. I might have been a little more diplomatic. Well, Pola paused a few moments to regain a certain minimal composure. It's not what I've brought you here for. You're the only outsider I've ever met that could be kind and noble, and I need your help. A cold pang shot through Arvidun. Was this what it was all about? He packed that thought into a cold, oh? And she cried, no, in return. It is not for me, Dr. Arvidun. It is for all the galaxy. Nothing for myself. Nothing.
What is it?
First, I don't think anyone followed us. But if you hear any noise at all, would you... Her eyes dropped. Put your arms about me and... You know. He nodded his head and said dryly, I believe I can improvise without any trouble. Is it necessary to wait for noise? Pola reddened. Please don't joke about it or mistake my intentions. It would be the only way of avoiding suspicion of our real intentions. It is the one thing that would be convincing. Arvidun said softly, Are things that serious? He looked at her curiously. She seemed so young and so soft. In a way, he felt it to be unfair. Never in his life did he act unreasoningly. He took pride in that. He was a man of strong emotions, but he fought them and beat them. And here, just because a girl seemed weak, he felt the unreasoning urge to protect her. She said, Things are that serious. I'm going to tell you something, and I know you won't believe it at first, but I want you to try to believe. I want you to make up your mind that I'm sincere, and most of all, I want you to decide that you will stick with us after I tell you and see it through. Will you try? I'll give you 15 minutes, and if you think at the end of that time that I'm not worth trusting or bothering with, I'll leave. And that's the end of it. 15 minutes? His lips quirked in an involuntary smile, and he removed his wristwatch and put it before him. All right. She clasped her hands in her lap and looked firmly ahead through the windshield that afforded a view only of the blank wall of the garage ahead. He watched her thoughtfully. A smooth, soft line of her chin, belying the firmness into which she was attempting to force it. The straight and thinly drawn nose, the peculiarly rich overtone to the complexion, so characteristic of Earth. He caught the corner of her eye upon him. It was hastily withdrawn. What's the matter? He said. She turned to him and caught her underlip in two teeth. I was watching you. Yes, I could see that. Smudge on my nose? No. She smiled tinily, the first since she had entered his car. He was becoming absurdly conscious of little things about her, the way her hair seemed to hover and float gently each time she shook her head. It's just that I've been wondering ever since that night
why you don't wear that lead clothing if you're an outsider. That's what fooled me. Outsiders generally look like sacks of potatoes.
And I don't?
Oh, no. And there was a sudden tinge of enthusiasm in her voice. You look quite like an ancient marble statue, except that you're alive and warm. I'm sorry. I'm being impertinent.
You mean you think that it's my opinion you're an Earth girl who doesn't know your place?
You'll have to stop thinking that of me, or we can't be friendly. I don't believe in the radioactivity superstition. I've measured the atmospheric radioactivity of Earth, and I've conducted laboratory experiments on animals. I'm quite convinced that under ordinary circumstances, the radiations won't hurt me. I've been here 2 months, and I don't feel sick yet. My hair isn't falling out. He pulled at it. My stomach isn't in knots. And I doubt that my fertility is being endangered, although I will admit to taking slight precautions in that respect. But lead-impregnated shorts, you see, don't show. He said that gravely, and she was smiling again. You're slightly mad, I think, she said.
Really?
You'd be surprised how many very intelligent and famous archaeologists have said that, and in long speeches, too. And she said suddenly, Will you listen to me now? The 15 minutes are up.
What do you think?
Why, that you might be. If you weren't, you wouldn't still be sitting here. Not after what I've done. He said softly, Are you under the impression that I have to force myself very hard to sit here next to you?
If you do, you're wrong.
Do you know, Pola, I really believe I've never seen a girl quite as beautiful as yourself. She looked up quickly with fright in her eyes. Please don't. I'm not trying for that. Don't you believe me?
Yes, I do, Pola.
Tell me whatever it is you want to. I'll believe it, and I'll help you. He believed himself implicitly. At the moment, Arvidun would cheerfully have undertaken to unseat the Emperor. He had never been in love before, and at that point he ground his thoughts to a halt. He had not used that word before.
Love? With an Earth girl?
You've seen my father, Dr. Arvidun. Dr. Schecht is your father. Please call me Belle. I'll call you Pola. If you want me to, I'll try. I suppose you were pretty angry with him.
He wasn't very polite.
He couldn't be. He's being watched. In fact, he and I arranged in advance that he was to get rid of you and I was to see you here. This is our house, you know. You see, her voice dropped to a tight whisper. Earth is going to revolt. Arvidun couldn't resist a moment of amusement. No, he said, opening his eyes wide. All of it? But Pola flared into instant fury. Don't laugh at me. You said you would listen and believe me. Earth is going to revolt, and it is serious, because Earth can destroy all the Empire.
Earth can do that?
Arvidun struggled successfully against a burst of laughter. He said gently, Pola, how well do you know your galactography?
As well as anybody, teacher, and what has that to do with it anyway?
It has this to do with it. The galaxy has a volume of several million cubic light years. It contains 200 million inhabited planets and an approximate population of 500 quadrillion people, right?
I suppose so, if you say so.
It is, believe me. Now, Earth is one planet, with a population of 20 million and no resources besides. In other words, there are 25 billion galactic citizens for every single Earthman. Now, what harm can Earth do against odds of 25 billion to one? For a moment the girl seemed to sink into doubt. Then she emerged. Belle, she said firmly, I can't answer that, but my father can. He has not told me the crucial details because he claims that that would endanger my life. But he will now if you come with me. He's told me that Earth knows a way by which it can wipe out all life outside Earth, and he must be right. He's always been right before. Her cheeks were pink with earnestness, and Arvidun longed to touch them. Had he ever before touched her and felt horrified at it? What was happening to him? Is it after 10? Asked Pola.
Yes, he replied.
Then he should be upstairs now, if they haven't caught him. She looked about with an involuntary shudder. We can get into the house directly from the garage now, and if you'll come with me... She had her hand on the knob that controlled the car door when she froze. Her voice was a husky whisper.
There's someone coming. Oh, quick!
The rest was smothered. It was anything but difficult for Arvidun to remember her original injunction. His arms swept about her with an easy motion, and in an instant she was warm and soft against him. Her lips trembled upon his and were limitless seas of sweetness. For about 10 seconds he swiveled his eyes to their extremes in an effort to see that first crack of light or hear that first footstep. But then he was drowned and swept under by the excitement of it all, blinded by stars, deafened by his own heartbeat. Her lips left his, but he sought them again, frankly, and found them. His arms tightened, and she melted within them until her own heartbeat was shaking him in time to his own. It was quite a while before they broke apart, and for a moment they rested, cheek against cheek. Arvidun had never been in love before, and this time he did not start at the word. What of it? Earth girl or not, the galaxy could not produce her equal. He said, with a dreamy pleasure, it must have been only a traffic noise.
It wasn't, she whispered. I didn't hear any noise.
He held her at arm's distance, but her eyes did not falter.
You devil.
Are you serious? Her eyes sparkled. I wanted you to kiss me.
I'm not sorry.
Do you think I am?
Kiss me again, then, for no reason but that I want to this time. Another long, long moment, and she was suddenly away from him, arranging her hair and adjusting the collar of her dress with prim and precise gestures. I think we'd better go into the house now. Put out the car light. I've got a pencil flash. He stepped out of the car after her, and in the new darkness she was the vaguest shadow in the little pockmark of light that came from her pencil flash. She said, you'd better hold my hand. There's a flight of stairs we must go up. His voice was a whisper behind her.
I love you, Pola.
It came out so easily, and it sounded so right. He said it again.
I love you, Pola.
She said softly,
you hardly know me.
No, all my life, I swear. All my life, Pola. For 2 months I've been thinking and dreaming of you. I swear it.
I am an Earth girl, sir.
Then I will be an Earth man.
Try me.
He stopped her and bent her head up gently until the pocket flash rested upon her flushed, tear-marked face.
Why are you crying?
Because when my father tells you what he knows, you will know that you cannot love an Earth girl. Try me on that, too. Chapter 15, The Odds That Vanished. Arvidun and Schecht met in a back room on the second story of the house, with the windows carefully polarized to complete opaqueness. Pola was downstairs, alert and sharp-eyed in the armchair from which she watched the dark and empty street. Schecht's stooped figure wore somehow an air different from that which Arvidun had observed some 10 hours previously. The physicist's face was still haggard and infinitely weary, but where previously it had seemed uncertain and timorous, it now bore an almost desperate defiance. Dr. Arvidun, he said, and his voice was firm, I must apologize for my treatment of you in the morning. I had hoped you would understand. I must admit I didn't, sir, but I believe I do now. Schecht seated himself at the table and gestured toward the bottle of wine. Arvidun waved his hand in a deprecating motion. If you don't mind, I'll have some of the fruit instead.
What is this? I don't think I've ever seen anything like it.
It's a kind of orange, said Schecht. I don't believe it grows outside Earth. The rind comes off easily. He demonstrated, and Arvidun, after sniffing at it curiously, sank his teeth into the winey pulp. He came up with an exclamation.
Why, this is delightful, Dr. Schecht.
Has Earth ever tried to export these objects?
The ancients, said the biophysicist grimly, are not fond of trading with the outside, nor are our neighbors in space fond of trading with us. It is but an aspect of our difficulties here. Arvidan felt a sudden spasm of annoyance seize him. That is the most stupid thing yet. I tell you that I could despair of human intelligence when I see what can exist in men's minds. Shet shrugged with the tolerance of lifelong use. It is part of the nearly insoluble problem of anti-terrestrialism, I fear. But what makes it so nearly insoluble, exclaimed the archaeologist, is that no one seems to really want a solution. How many Earthmen respond to the situation by hating all galactic citizens indiscriminately? It is an almost universal disease, hate for hate. Do your people really want equality, mutual tolerance? No. Most of them want only their own turn as top dog. Perhaps there is much in what you say, said Shek sadly. I cannot deny it. But that is not the whole story. Give us but the chance, and a new generation of Earthmen would grow to maturity, lacking insularity, and believing wholeheartedly in the oneness of man. The assimilationists, with their tolerance and belief in wholesome compromise, have more than once been a power on Earth. I am one. Or at least I was one once. But the zealots rule all Earth now. They are the extreme nationalists with their dreams of past rule and future rule. It is against them that the Empire must be protected. Arvidan frowned. You refer to the revolt Pola spoke of? Dr. Arvidan, Schecht said grimly, it's not too easy a job to convince anyone of such an apparently ridiculous possibility as Earth conquering the galaxy. But it's true. I am not physically brave, and I am most anxious to live. You can imagine, then, the immense crisis that must now exist to force me to run the risk of committing treason with the eye of the local administration already upon me. Well, said Arvidan, if it is that serious, I had better tell you one thing immediately. I will help you all I can, but only in my own capacity as a galactic citizen. I have no official standing here, nor have I any particular influence at the court or even at the procurator's palace. I am exactly what I seem to be, an archaeologist on a scientific expedition which involves only my own interests. Since you are prepared to risk treason, hadn't you better see the procurator about this? He could really do something. That is exactly what I cannot do, Dr. Arvidan. It is that very contingency against which the ancients guard me. When you came to my house this morning, I even thought you might be a go-between. I thought that Ennius suspected. He may suspect. I cannot answer for that. But I am not a go-between. I'm sorry. If you insist on making me your confidant, I can promise to see him for you. Thank you. It is all I ask. That, and to use your good offices to intercede for Earth against too strong a reprisal. Of course. Arvidan was uneasy. At the moment he was convinced that he was dealing with an elderly and eccentric paranoiac, perhaps harmless, but thoroughly cracked. Yet he had no choice but to remain, to listen, and to try to smooth over the gentle insanity, for Pola's sake. Shet said, Dr. Arvidan, you have heard of the synapsifier? You said so this morning. Yes, I did. I read your original article in Physical Reviews. I discussed the instrument with the procurator and with the High Minister. With the High Minister? Why, certainly. When I obtained the letter of introduction that you, refused to see, I'm afraid. I'm sorry for that. But I wish you had not. What is the extent of your knowledge concerning the synapsifier? That it is an interesting failure? It is designed to improve learning capacity. It has succeeded to some extent on rats, but has failed on human beings. Schecht was chagrined. Yes, you could think nothing else from that article. It was publicized as a failure, and the eminently successful results have been suppressed, deliberately. A rather unusual display of scientific ethics, Dr. Schecht. I admit it. But I am 56, sir. And if you know anything of the customs of Earth, you know that I haven't long to live. The 60. Yes, I have heard of it. More than I would have liked, in fact. And he thought wryly of that first trip on a terrestrial stratoliner. Exceptions are made for noted scientists, among others I have heard. Certainly. But it is the High Minister and the Council of Ancients who decide on that, and there is no appeal from their decisions, even to the Emperor. I was told that the price of life was secrecy concerning the synapsifier and hard work for its improvement. The older man spread his hands helplessly. Could I know then of the outcome of the use to which the machine would be put? And the use? Arvidan extracted a cigarette from his shirt pocket case and offered one to the other, which was refused. If you'll wait a moment. One by one, after my experiments had reached the point where I felt the instrument might be safely applied to human beings, certain of Earth's biologists were treated. In each case, they were men I knew to be in sympathy with the zealots, the extremists, that is. They all survived, though secondary effects made themselves shown after a time. One of them was brought back for treatment eventually. I could not save him. But in his dying delirium, I found out. It was close upon midnight. The day had been long and much had happened. But now something stirred within Arvidan. He said tightly, "I wish you'd get to the point." Chet said, "I beg your patience. I must explain thoroughly if you're to believe me. You, of course, know of Earth's peculiar environment, its radioactivity." "Yes, I have a fair knowledge of the matter." "And of the effect of this radioactivity upon Earth and its economy?" "Yes." "Then I won't belabor the point. I need only say that the incidence of mutation on Earth is greater than in the rest of the galaxy. The idea of our enemies that Earthmen are different thus has a certain basis of physical truth. To be sure, the mutations are minor, and most possess no survival value. If any permanent change has occurred in Earthmen, it is only in some aspects of their internal chemistry which enables them to display greater resistance to their own particular environment. Thus they show greater resistance to radiation effects, more rapid healing of burned tissues. Dr. Schecht, I am acquainted with all you say. Then has it ever occurred to you that these mutational processes occur in living species on Earth other than human? There was a short silence, and then Arvidan said, Why, no, it hasn't, though, of course, it is quite inevitable now that you mention it. That is so. It happens. Our domestic animals exist in greater variety than on any other inhabited world. The orange you ate is a mutated variety which exists nowhere else. It is this, among other things, which makes the orange so unacceptable for export. Outsiders suspect it, as they suspect us, and we ourselves guard it as a valuable property peculiar to ourselves. And, of course, what applies to animals and plants also applies to microscopic life. And now, indeed, Arvidan felt the thin pang of fear enter. He said, You mean bacteria? I mean the whole domain of primitive life, protozoa, bacteria, and the self-reproducing proteins that some people call viruses. And what are you getting at? I think you have a notion of that, Dr. Arvidan. You seem suddenly interested. You see, there is a belief among your people that Earthmen are bringers of death, that to associate with an Earthman is to die, that Earthmen are the bearers of misfortune, possess a sort of evil eye. I know all that. It is merely superstition. Not entirely. That is the dreadful part. Like all common beliefs, however superstitious, distorted, and perverted, it has a speck of truth at bottom. Sometimes, you see, an Earthman carries within his body some mutated form of microscopic parasite which is not quite like any known elsewhere, and to which, sometimes, outsiders are not particularly resistant. What follows is simple biology, Dr. Arvidan. Arvidan was silent. Schecht went on, We are caught sometimes, too, of course. A new species of germ will make its way out of the radioactive mists, and an epidemic will sweep the planet. But by and large, Earthmen have kept pace. For each variety of germ and virus, we build our defense over the generations, and we survive. Outsiders don't have the opportunity. Do you mean, said Arvidun with a strangely faint sensation, that contact with you now... He pushed his chair back. He was thinking of the evening's kisses. Shet shook his head. Of course not. We don't create the disease, we merely carry it. And even such carriage occurs very rarely. If I lived on your world, I would no more carry the germ than you would. I have no special affinity for it. Even here, it is only one out of every quadrillion germs, or one out of every quadrillion of quadrillions, that is dangerous. The chances of your infection right now are less than that of a meteorite penetrating the roof of this house and hitting you. Unless the germs in question are deliberately searched for, isolated, and concentrated. Again, a silence. Longer this time. Arvidun said in a queer, strangled voice, Have Earthmen been doing that? He had stopped thinking in terms of paranoia. He was ready to believe. Yes, but for innocent reasons at first. Our biologists are, of course, particularly interested in the peculiarities of Earth life, and recently isolated the virus of common fever. What is common fever? A mild endemic disease on Earth. That is, it is always with us. Most Earthmen have it in their childhood, and its symptoms are not very severe. A mild fever, a transitory rash and inflammation of the joints and of the lips, combined with an annoying thirst. It runs its course in 4 to 6 days, and the subject is thereafter immune. I've had it. Pola has had it. Occasionally there is a more virulent form of this same disease. A slightly different strain of virus is concerned, presumably. And then it is called radiation fever. Radiation fever. I've heard of it, said Arvidun. Oh, really? It is called radiation fever because of the mistaken notion that it is caught after exposure to radioactive areas. Actually, exposure to radioactive areas is often followed by radiation fever, because it is in those areas that the virus is most apt to mutate to dangerous forms. But it is the virus and not the radiation which does it. In the case of radiation fever, symptoms develop in a matter of 2 hours. The lips are so badly affected that the subject can scarcely talk, and he may be dead in a matter of days. Now, Dr. Arvidun, this is the crucial point. The Earthman has adapted himself to common fever, and the outsider has not. Occasionally, a member of the Imperial Garrison is exposed to it, and in that case, he reacts to it as an Earthman would do to radiation fever. Usually he dies within 12 hours. He is then burned by Earthmen, since any other soldier approaching also dies. The virus, as I say, was isolated 10 years ago. It is a nucleoprotein, as are most filterable viruses, which, however, possesses the remarkable property of containing an unusually high concentration of radioactive carbon, sulfur, and phosphorus. When I say unusually high, I mean that 50% of its carbon, sulfur, and phosphorus is radioactive. It is supposed that the effects of the organism on its host is largely that of its radiations rather than of its toxins. Naturally, it would seem logical that Earthmen, who are adapted to gamma radiations, are only slightly affected. Original research in the virus centered at first about the method whereby it concentrated its radioactive isotopes. As you know, no chemical means can separate isotopes except through very long and tedious procedures, nor is any organism other than this virus known which can do so. But then the direction of the research changed. I'll be short, Dr. Arvidun, and I think you see the rest. Experiments might be conducted on animals from outside Earth, but not on outsiders themselves. The numbers of outsiders on Earth were too few to allow several to disappear without notice, nor could premature discovery of their plans be allowed. So it was a group of bacteriologists that was sent to the synapsifier to return with insights enormously developed. It was they who developed a new mathematical attack on protein chemistry and on immunology, which enabled them, finally, to develop an artificial strain of virus that was designed to affect galactic human beings, outsiders only. tons of the crystallized virus now exist. Alverdon was haggard. He felt the drops of perspiration glide sluggishly down his temple and cheek. "Then you are telling me," he gasped, "that Earth intends to set loose this virus on the galaxy, that they will initiate a gigantic bacteriological warfare, which we cannot lose, and you cannot win." "Exactly. Once the epidemic starts, millions will die each day, and nothing will stop it. Frightened refugees fleeing across space will carry the virus with them, and if you attempt to blow up entire planets, the disease can be started again in new centers. There will be no reason to connect the matter with Earth. By the time our own survival becomes suspicious, the ravages will have progressed so far, the despair of the outsiders will be so deep that nothing will matter to them." "And all will die?" The appalling horror did not penetrate, could not. "Perhaps not. Our new science of bacteriology works both ways. We have the antitoxin as well, and the means of production thereof. It might be used in case of early surrender. Then there may be some out-of-the-way eddies of the galaxy that could escape, or even a few cases of natural immunity." In the horrible blankness that followed, during which Arvidan never thought of doubting the truth of what he had heard, the horrible truth which at a stroke wiped out the odds of 25 billion to 1, Shek's voice was small and tired. "It is not Earth that is doing this. A handful of leaders, perverted by the gigantic pressure that excluded them from the galaxy, hating those who keep them outside, wanting to strike back at any cost and with insane intensity. Once they have begun, the rest of Earth must follow. What can it do? In its tremendous guilt, it will have to finish what it started. Could it allow enough of the galaxy to survive and thus risk a later punishment? Yet, before I am an Earthman, I am a man. Must trillions die for the sake of millions? Must a civilization spreading over a galaxy crumble for the sake of the resentment, however justified, of a single planet? And will we be better off for all that? The power in the galaxy will reside still on those worlds with the necessary resources, and we have none. Earthmen may even rule at Trantor for a generation, but their children will become Trantorians, and in their turn will look down upon the remnant on Earth. And besides, is there an advantage to humanity to exchange the tyranny of a galaxy for the tyranny of Earth? No. No. There must be a way out for all men, a way to justice and freedom." His hand stole to his face, and behind their gnarled fingers he rocked gently to and fro. Arvidan had heard all this in a numbed haze. He mumbled, "There is no treason in what you have done, Dr. Shett. I will go to Everest immediately. The procurator will believe me. He must believe me." There was the sound of running footsteps, the flash of a frightened face into the room, the door left swinging open. "Father, men are coming up the walk." Dr. Shett went gray. "Quickly, Dr. Arvidan, through the garage." He was pushing violently. "Take Pola and don't worry about me. I'll hold them back." But a man in a green robe waited for them as they turned. He wore a thin smile and carried, with a casual ease, a neuronic whip. There was a thunder of fists at the main door, a crash, and the sound of pounding feet. "Who are you?" demanded Arvidan in a feeble defiance of the armed green robe. He had stepped before Pola. "I..." said Greenrobe harshly. "I am merely the humble secretary of His Excellency the High Minister." He advanced. "I almost waited too long, but not quite. A girl, too." "Injudicious," Arvidan said evenly. "I am a galactic citizen, and I dispute your right to detain me, or for that matter to enter this house without legal authority. I..." and the secretary tapped his chest gently with his free hand, "am all the right and authority on this planet. Within a short time, I will be all the right and authority in the galaxy. We have all of you, you know, even Schwartz." "Schwartz!" cried Dr. Schecht and Pola nearly together. "You are surprised? Come, I will bring you to him."
The last thing Arvidun was conscious of was that smile expanding and the flash of the whip. He toppled through a crimson sear of pain into unconsciousness. Chapter 16. Choose Your Side. For the moment, Schwartz was resting uneasily on a hard bench in one of the small sub-basement rooms of the Shika Hall of Correction. The hall, as it was commonly termed, was the great token of the local power of the High Minister and those surrounding him. It lifted its gloominess in a rocky, angular height. It overshadowed the imperial barracks beyond it, just as its shadow clutched at the terrestrial malefactor far more than did the unexerted authority of the Empire. Within its walls, many an earthman in past centuries had waited for the judgment that came to one who falsified or evaded the quotas of production, who lived past his time, or connived at another such crime, or who was guilty of attempting subversion of the local government. Occasionally, when the petty prejudices of terrestrial justice made particularly little sense to the sophisticated and usually blasé imperial government of the time, a conviction might be set aside by the procurator, but this meant insurrection, or at the very least, wild riots. Ordinarily, where the council demanded death, the procurator yielded. After all, it was only Earthmen who suffered. Of all this, Joseph Schwartz very naturally knew nothing. To him, immediate optical awareness consisted of a small room, its walls transfused with but a dim light, its furniture consisting of two hard benches and a table, plus a small recess in the wall that served as washroom and sanitary convenience combined. There was no window for a glimpse of sky, and the drift of air into the room through the ventilating shaft was feeble. He rubbed the hair that circled his bald spot and sat up ruefully. His attempt to escape to nowhere, for where on earth was he safe, had been short, not sweet, and had ended here. At least there was the mind touch to play with. But was that bad or good? At the farm, it had been a queer, disturbing gift, the nature of which he did not know, the possibilities of which he did not think of. Now it was a flexible gift to be investigated. With nothing to do for 24 hours but brood on imprisonment, he could have been courting madness. As it was, he could touch the jailers as they passed, reach out for guardsmen in the adjacent corridors, extend the furthest fibrils of his mind even to the captain of the hall in his distant office. He turned the minds over delicately and probed them. They fell apart like so many walnuts, dry husks out of which emotions and notions fell in a sibilant rain. He learned much in the process of Earth and Empire, more than he had or could have in all 2 months on the farm. Of course, one of the items that he learned over and over again beyond any chance of mistaking was just this. He was condemned to death. There was no escape. No doubt, no reservation. It might be today, it might be tomorrow, but he would die. Somehow it sank in, and he accepted it almost gratefully. The door opened, and he was on his feet in tense fear. One might accept death reasoningly with every aspect of the conscious mind, but the body was a brute beast that knew nothing of reason. This was it. No. It wasn't. The entering mind touch held nothing of death in it. It was a guard with a metal rod held ready in his hand. Schwartz knew what it was. "Come with me," he said sharply. Schwartz followed him, speculating on this odd power of his. Long before his guard could use his weapon, long before he could possibly know he should, he could be struck down without a sound, without a giveaway moment. His mind was in Schwartz's mental hands. A slight squeeze, and it would be over. But why? There would be others. How many could he handle at once? How many pairs of hands were in his mind? He followed docilely. It was a large, large room that he was brought into. Two men and a girl occupied it, stretched out corpse-wise on high, high benches. Yet not corpses, since three active minds were much in evidence. Paralyzed. Familiar? Were they familiar?
He was stopping to look, but the guard's hard hand was on his shoulder. Get on. There was a fourth slab, empty. There was no death in the guard's mind, so Schwartz climbed on. He knew what was coming. The guard's steely rod touched each of his limbs. They tingled and left him, so that he was nothing but a head floating on nothingness. He turned it. Pola, he cried. You're Pola, aren't you? The girl who... She was nodding. He hadn't recognized her touch as such. He had never been aware of it that time 2 months ago. At that time, his mental progression had reached only the stage of sensitivity to atmosphere. In the brilliance of hindsight, he remembered that well. But from the contents, he could still learn much. The one past the girl was Dr. Schecht. The one furthest of all was Dr. Bell Arvidan. He could filch their names, sense their despair, taste the last dregs of horror and fright in the young girl's mind. For a moment, he pitied them. And then he remembered who they were and what they were. And he hardened his heart. Let them die. The other three had been there for the better part of an hour. The room in which they were left was evidently one used for assemblies of several hundred. The prisoners were lost and lonely in its size, nor was there anything to say. Arvidan's throat burned dryly, and he turned his head from side to side with a futile restlessness. It was the only part of his body that he could move. Schecht's eyes were closed, and his lips were colorless and pinched. Arvidan whispered fiercely, "Schecht! Schecht, I say!" "What? What?" A feeble whisper at best. "What are you doing? Going to sleep? Think, man, think!" "Why? What is there to think of? Who is this Joseph Schwartz?" Pola's voice sounded thin and weary. "Don't you remember, Belle? That time in the department store when I first met you so long ago?" Arvidan wrenched wildly and found he could lift his head 2 aching inches. A bit of Pola's face was just visible. "Pola! Pola!" If he could have moved toward her, as for 2 months he might have and hadn't. She was looking at him, smiling so wanly that it might be a statue smile, and he said, "We'll win out yet. You'll see." But she was shaking her head, and his neck gave way, its tendons in panging agony. "Schecht," he said again, "listen to me. How did you meet this Schwartz? Why was he a patient of yours?" "The synapsifier. He came as a volunteer."
"And was treated?"
"Yes." Arvidan revolved that in his mind. "What made him come to you?"
"I don't know."
"But then, maybe he is an Imperial agent." Schwartz followed his thought well and smiled to himself. He said nothing, and he meant to keep on saying nothing. Schecht stirred his head. "An Imperial agent? You mean because the High Priest's secretary says he is?" "Oh, nonsense. And what difference does it make? He's as helpless as we." "Listen, Arvidan, maybe if we tell some sort of concerted story, they might wait. Eventually we might..." The archaeologist laughed hollowly, and his throat burned at the friction. "We might live, you mean? With the galaxy dead and civilization in ruins? Live? I might as well die."
"I'm thinking of Pola," muttered Schecht.
"I am too," said the other. "Ask her. Pola, shall we surrender? Shall we try to live?" Pola's voice was firm. "I have chosen my side. I don't want to die, but if my side dies, I'll go with it." Arvidan felt somehow triumphant. When he brought her to Sirius, they might call her an Earth girl, but she was their equal, and he would, with a great and good pleasure, smash teeth into the throat of any... And he remembered that he wasn't likely to bring her to Sirius, to bring anyone to Sirius. There wasn't likely to be a Sirius. Then, as though to escape from the thought, to escape anywhere, he shouted, "You! What's your name? Schwartz!"
Schwartz raised his head for a moment and allowed a glance to ooze out toward the other. He still said nothing. "Who are you?" demanded Arvidan. "How did you get mixed up in this? What's your part in it?" And at the question, all the injustice of everything descended on Schwartz. All the harmlessness of his past, all the infinite horror of the present burst in upon him, so that he said in a fury, "I? How did I get mixed up in it? Listen, I was once a nobody, an honest man, a hard-working tailor. I hurt nobody, I bothered nobody, I took care of my family. And then, for no reason, I came here." "Tushika?" asked Arvidan, who did not quite follow. "No, not Tushika," shouted Schwartz in wild derision. "I came to this whole mad world. Oh, what do I care if you believe me or not? My world is in the past. My world had land and food and 2 billion people, and it was the only world." Arvidan fell silent before the verbal assault. He turned to Schecht. "Can you understand him?" "Do you realize," said Schecht in feeble wonder, "that he has a vermiform appendix which is 3.5 inches long? Do you remember, Pola? And wisdom teeth? And hair on his face?" "Yes, yes," shouted Schwartz defiantly. "And I wish I had a tail I could show you. I'm from the past. I traveled through time. Only I don't know how, and I don't know why. Now leave me alone." He added suddenly, "They will soon be here for us. This wait is just to break us." Arvidan said suddenly, "Do you know that? Who told you?" Schwartz did not answer. "Was it the secretary, stocky man with a pug nose?" Schwartz had no way of telling the physical appearance of those he touched only by mind, but secretary. There had been just a glimpse of a touch, a powerful one of a man of power, and it seemed he had been a secretary. "Balkis?" he asked in curiosity. "What?" said Arvidan, but Schecht interrupted. "That's the name of the secretary." "Oh, what did he say?" "He didn't say anything," said Schwartz. "I know. It's death for all of us, and there's no way out." Arvidan lowered his voice. "He's mad, wouldn't you say?" "I wonder. His skull sutures now, they were primitive, very primitive." Arvidan was amazed. "You mean... Oh, come, it's impossible." "I've always supposed so." For the moment, Schecht's voice was a feeble imitation of normality, as though the presence of a scientific problem had switched his mind to that detached and objective groove in which personal matters disappeared. "They've calculated the energy required to displace matter along the time axis, and a value greater than infinity was arrived at, so the project has always been looked upon as impossible. But others have talked of the possibility of time faults, analogous to geological faults, you know. Spaceships have disappeared, for one thing, almost in full view. There's the famous case of Hor de Valo in ancient times, who stepped into his house one day and never came out, and wasn't inside either. And then there's the planet, which you will find in the galactography books of the last century, which was visited by 3 expeditions that brought back full descriptions, and then was never seen again. Then there are certain developments in nuclear chemistry that seem to deny the law of conservation of mass energy. They've tried to explain that by postulating the escape of some mass along the time axis. Uranium nuclei, for instance, when mixed with copper and barium, in minute but definite proportions, under the influence of light gamma irradiation, set up a resonating system. "Father," said Pola, "don't. There's no use." But Arvidan's interruption was peremptory. "Wait now. Let me think. I'm the one who can settle this. Who better? Let me ask him a few questions. Look, Schwartz." Schwartz looked up again. "Yours was the only world in the galaxy?" Schwartz nodded, then said dully, "Yes." "But you only thought that. I mean, you didn't have space travel, so you couldn't check up. There might have been many other inhabited worlds.
I have no way of telling that.
Yes, of course. A pity.
What about atomic power?
We had an atomic bomb. Uranium and plutonium.
I guess that's what made this world radioactive.
There must have been another war after all, after I left.
Atomic bombs.
Somehow Schwartz was back in Chicago, back in his old world before the bombs. And he was sorry. Not for himself, but for that beautiful world. But Arvidin was muttering to himself. Then, all right. You had a language, of course.
Earth?
Lots of them.
How about you?
English, after I was a grown man.
Well, say something in it.
For 2 months or more, Schwartz had said nothing in English. But now, with lovingness, he said slowly, I want to go home and be with my own people. End of side 4.